Position number 21613, Reel 11.
This is the sixth reel of a taped interview with Peter David Cockburn Salmon in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 2nd of the 4th, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Peter, I was wondering whether you'd had any contact with your family in Western Australia during the time that you were at Octu.
Oh, yes. Yes, when I finished Octu, I had a couple of weeks' leave at home in Perth before going back to Queensland. Oh, yes, I did.
And what was that like, coming back again? You've been back now a couple of times.
Yes. Oh, it was very good, but it was quite lonely because nearly all my friends, of course, were in the services, and there were only just a very few at home that of my close friends. In fact, it might have only been one or two. And most of the girls were in some form, they were in VADs, or they were in the RAMs, or they were all in service, really. But it was very pleasant just to be at home with the family, with my mother, and one of my sisters was living with her two young children with my mother at the time during the war, while her husband was in the Air Force, he was away. And it was more or less just a family time, really. At one stage, the few officers did come back from the 2nd 28th on leave, and I saw them, but it was very pleasant. Lots of good food and lots of rest, a few beers.
Did you talk anything about your experiences at that
point? Not really, no. No, I didn't sort of... I didn't want to talk to my parents about it, really, because I knew that they... See, my parents were quite a lot older than I was, because I'm the youngest of six children, and I was younger than my brother by 9 years, and my parents were a lot older, so they had vivid memories of the First World War, of course. And my father had lost a brother in the war, and he'd had another brother also who fought in the war. So they were very aware of it, but I didn't want to sort of let them even think about the risks that perhaps we were having, because they were thinking enough about it anyhow.
Mm. So on leaving again, what was the situation? You mentioned that you found out about going to Labuan in Queensland.
Yes, when we got back, when I got back, but that wasn't until I'd been through the staging camp, been posted to Second Fourth, and we'd been in some training on the tableland before we even, you know, when we actually knew we were going to Labuan.
What did they tell you about going to Labuan?
Well, then they started to explain all what was going to happen on the beachhead and so forth. We had lots of conferences on it.
Can you recall the main principle of the idea and the reasons why you were going there?
Well, no, I think that it was just really that it was, of course, it was an airfield there, and Labuan was comparatively well defended by the Japs, quite a lot of Japs there, and it was probably a strategic stepping stone to Borneo, where they were getting very worried about the prisoners of war and the civilian prisoners, particularly the ones in North Borneo and at Kuching. So I think they were wanted to get into Borneo as quickly as they could, and Labuan was a staging point for that.
We're just checking dates, and it would have been around May, June that you would have been going off to Labuan. As I understand, we're approaching, you know, the end of the war.
Yeah.
To what degree were people aware that there was, you know, not that much longer to go?
Well, I think really, from our point of view, we thought there was a lot longer to go. I suppose the only person who thought there might not be much longer to go was Mr. Truman in Washington. He knew they were going to drop the bomb. But all the rest of us thought it was a lot to go.
There was that question that the whole Labu and Borneo operation wasn't necessary.
I think the Labu and Borneo operation was, in my book, was far more necessary than the New Guinea landing that we did, because we just simply had to get into Kuching and get... We didn't actually know that, but I'm sure the authorities knew it. Had to get into Kuching and get the prisoners out in case the same thing happened to them as happened in North Borneo. And it very easily could have.
What were some of the things that you were hearing about the situation in North Borneo?
We weren't hearing anything at all. Now, we didn't know at that stage that what had happened. But I, of course, the command did, because there were Z Force people and so in North Borneo who knew what had happened, but they couldn't do anything about it. Of course, they had no way of helping them, because they were just scouts, very small parties getting the information out.
What were you to later hear then?
Well. I don't think that actually we knew. I can't remember that we knew when we got to Kuching at any stage what had happened to the people in North Borneo. In fact, I'm certain we didn't. Actually, we might have been much nastier to the Japs had we known that. But I had to take my platoon up on the first corvette that went into Kuching. And Kuching was a very heavily armed Japanese place. There's lots of Japs there. And they had lots of outposts all over the place. And it was a very nasty feeling coming in there, because we didn't know if the commander there had accepted the Emperor's call for surrender. But our main job there was to help the people in the prisoner of war camps. And actually I got to know very well a doctor, Mrs. O'Connor. There, he was the chief medical officer in Singapore, and he'd gone to Borneo to let the medical officer at Kuching go on leave, and he and his wife were trapped there, and they'd had a fairly rough time. They had a Japanese doctor who was a drunkard, and there also was another lady doctor who was taken, and he used to beat her up, and she had a very bad time. But the commander of fortunately at Kuching liked children, and he used to take the children often out on his rounds round the post in his car. But the women had a pretty rough time. They had to work out in the heat on the fields growing vegetables, and it's not exactly women's work, or not for European women, and not used to it. And it was pretty grim. And Dr. O'Connor often used to tell me that he could see the wire of the army portion, the services part of the camp, was not far away. He could see fellas dying, and he could do nothing about it, of course. And then, of course, we had a hospital ship. We got everybody out to the hospital ships, those that needed to go. And some of them were in a very, very poor state indeed. But it's a pretty place, Kuching. Lovely place. I'd like to go back there. Mm. Quite a big Chinese population. And the Chinese were very good. I think they helped the prisoners a lot. They risked their own lives in getting, sometimes sneaking stuff into the camps for people. And they didn't like the Japs, of course. Hated the Japs. But
Of the officers that you met... in Kuching, what were they like on your arrival?
The Jap officers. Well, I can always remember one fellow who spoke very, very good English on the wharf, and he was very arrogant sort of a chap. But they did cooperate, and we of course had to disarm them all, take masses of arms to take. But they were pretty cooperative, actually. Amazingly so, really, when you think of how they'd not 5 minutes before almost they'd been fighting to the death. But Borneo also would have been a rather nasty campaign, I think, if we'd had to fight it.
And but thank goodness we got them all out, these prisoners out.
We can go back a little way if we can. Talk about the arrival at Labuan. What was that like? And were you involved with the landing there?
Oh, yes, yes. We did the landing, actually. We did the beach here, our battalion. And there was a very, very heavy naval bombardment of Labuan before we went in. And then we went in on landing craft. And we established the beachhead without too much opposition. The Japs had withdrawn into defensive positions further back from the beach. We established the beachhead, took up defensive positions, and the rest of the force then passed through us, and including the 2nd 28th, and then the battle for Labuan began, which was quite a big battle there. But it was further away from the beachhead.
As I understand, people weren't aware just how heavy the fighting would be.
No, they weren't.
What sort of exposure to that fighting did you have?
No, we didn't have terribly much. The main exposure to what we had was Japanese infiltrators coming in. And we captured a few Japs that way. I can still see about 8 young Japs. I don't think they could have been, I reckon they would have been, probably not 20. Lying on the ground, they'd been disarmed, these Japs. And they were lying on the ground. I'm sure they thought they were about to be executed. And they were just shaking like leaves. Their whole bodies were shaking with terror. And but the Japs, they used to come in, and in fact they got into some tents. One chap woke up in the middle of the night with a Jap standing over him with a great big sword, and he lifted up his hand like that, and the Jap came down with his sword, and he went straight through the fingers and split his arm right open, just right through the bone and everything. There were beggars at that. They used to come in and come in at night.
So your situation at Labuan was to hold the beachhead.
That's right, and establish the beachhead and protect the, or so that all the suppliers could come in for the to support the forces actually taking part in the.
What was the camp like?
Well, it wasn't too bad. It wasn't bad at Labuan. No, it was quite good. It was quite reasonable. We had an outer perimeter defence, of course, and. No, the conditions were reasonable there, of course, because they were able to get stuff in from the sea. And no, it wasn't as army living goes. It wasn't tough.
It wasn't quite as bad as some of the conditions you experienced in New
York. No, not at all. No. And then, when of course the fighting was over there, and then we had a mopping up job. We had to go out and mop up the island. And I did a bit of that with my platoon, took it out and cleaned up a few areas, but we didn't get much Jap resistance.
What did that involve?
Well, it just a matter of contacting the villagers to find out if there were any Japs about, and that was the main thing. And then if you found them, was to round them up, hopefully that they wouldn't be aggressive.
In the main,
they'd got the message. They'd had a hell of a bombardment, of course. They'd been really heavily bombarded, and they were a bit shell-shocked, I think, a lot of them.
You mentioned earlier on the prisoners that you'd taken shaking all over. In that respect, how did seeing the Japanese soldiers close up change your attitudes towards...
Well, I suppose they become a little bit more like human beings then when you see them in that situation. But they tended to be very unpredictable, you know. If you got them into... I think at one stage in Labuan there was an attempt to break out of the prisoner of war cage by the Japs. And they were very unpredictable. You never just quite knew what they'd do, because life to them wasn't the same as it was to us.
unless they thought they were going to get anywhere by giving their lives and blowing you up, they'd do it drop of a hat. So taking Japs prisoners was not quite as safe a proposition as taking a German. Sorry.
You went in for the landing at Labuan, and there was this heavy bombardment.
Mm.
What is it like being in a landing situation, not quite knowing what it's going to be like once you hit shore?
No, you get. I think everybody's frightened, of course. I think you get quite frightened in that situation because you're cooped up on these landing craft, and you're fairly vulnerable, of course, because you've all got to get off and up out of the craft in a fairly small opening. And for somebody with machine guns not too far back on the beach, you're very vulnerable at that stage with mortar fire and machine gun fire. So it's always a fairly tricky time. And of course, they get seasick. Folks get seasick because they're full of nerves, and that, I think, tends to make some get seasick. But fortunately, we didn't strike opposition on the beach. We were very prepared that we wouldn't.
You mentioned there wasn't the heavy resistance that you'd expected, but. Over the time you were there, it took a lot longer than you'd anticipated.
Oh yes, the resistance came further back from the beachhead. That came from the battalions that passed through the beachhead. They then struck the opposition.
I'm interested to talk about the ideas that some people even had at that time that the Borneo campaign wasn't necessary. We did mention a little bit earlier on that you thought it was. Some of the areas that I was most interested in were, it seemed to go against MacArthur's idea of actually sort of bypassing areas and letting the Japanese soldiers wither on the vine.
Well, I always thought more that New Guinea, not the Owen Stanleys, not the Kakata Trail part, but the Labu and Finchhafen part, I always thought seemed to go against what he, but I think that was something to do with blaming. But Borneo, I still feel, was very necessary.
I understand that Blamey was concerned, and the government, I presume, was concerned that they weren't going to get a fair share at the peace table.
Yeah, well, you see, I don't think MacArthur really wanted them to have much of a share at the peace table. Quite certainly didn't, because here there was a fair bit of friction between, unknown to us, of course, between him and the Blamey in our command at that stage. I think he wanted the Americans to really take the full kudos for the majority of what was going to happen from there on.
There was this idea that, possibly to come later on, that MacArthur saw the Australian troops as secondary.
Mm.
Is that something you felt at the time?
No, definitely not, but I believe afterwards we've since, historically, we've found out that he did look on us as being a little bit second rate, but he little knows that we looked on a lot of his troops as being a bit second rate too. They needed the Americans, were some very good soldiers amongst them, of course, I'm not taking that away, but they needed much more support than the Australians ever got to do the same sort of a job. They absolutely blasted the living daylights out of everywhere they landed, and we didn't get that sort of support. We got it at Labuan to an extent, but nothing like the Americans used to throw it before the landing came in. Huge naval bombardment. But the Americans did wonderful, Guadalcanal Canal and a lot of the fighting there was tremendous what they did. I'm not decrying that, but I think to say the Australians were second-rate troops was pretty untrue, I think.
Possibly in MacArthur's ideas, I'm not suggesting that they were necessarily in reality. I was wanting to know whether, the fact that the Americans used all of this artillery and had this huge backup, whether that was actually just a sign of a more efficient army.
No, I think it gave a sign of an army that was backed by many millions and millions of dollars compared to what the Australians were. I think the answer was that. There was the same thing applied to Americans' pay, which left ours for dead. You know, they were ever so much better paid than we were. And it was just a matter of cold, hard cash. And an immense country putting its weight behind its troops, which we just didn't have. And most of what we got, really, was we had to, and Britain was a bit the same, we had to rely on America for aid. And Lend-Lease was that to Britain. They didn't have the same manufacturing ability. Despite its size, it was nothing compared to America. And I think it caused a bit of resentment, of course, amongst the Australians that the Americans sort of tended to come and take over. But we might have done the same thing in the same position, so can't be too critical. But at the time, it caused some resentment. Yeah.
Where were you when you first heard of the victory over the Japanese?
Labuan. We're in the camp at Labuan where it had all finished. We're in camp, and I can still see now that the local Japanese commander's plane coming in to land at Labuan for the meeting on the signing of the peace. And after that we went to Borneo, of course.
Was this Akashi?
I don't know who the general was. It probably could have been. Yes, I'm not quite sure what. I haven't really read that part up on who he was.
What was it that you heard, and how did you hear about it?
Well, it was very soon after the plane had got it all circulated through the camp that the war had finished.
So you hadn't actually heard it on radio?
No. Yeah. And then it came through the camp.
Had you heard how it had been achieved, the final victory?
No, I think that came later.
When did you learn about the atomic bomb?
I should think it would have been maybe a week or 10 days after that, I would have thought. We really learned how it had come about.
What was it that you were told?
Well, just I think that the bomb had been dropped and the Japs had surrendered. You know.
What had you been told about the bomb, though?
Nothing much at all. Nobody really, just that it was some immense bomb that had done the job. But never had no details. Because we had no papers or anything like that, no correspondence to supply anything to us. We were kept pretty much in the dark, really.
What was the general feeling of victory? It's finally come. I get the impression that actually there wasn't a huge amount of celebration.
No, there wasn't, but I think everybody said, when am I going to get home?
Let the truck go by?
Yeah, when am I going to get home was on everybody's lips, I think.
What was the reality of knowing when you were going to get home?
Well, you were all graded, you see. You were graded according to how long you'd been in the services. So I got out the first lot, because I'd been 5 years and 6 months. And I came home on one of the what used to be one of our passenger ships, the Canimbla, brought me back.
Before, you mentioned that you had to go and you know, make sure that the Japanese who were on the island had surrendered and that sort of thing.
They had to clean up all the pockets around. Otherwise, you see, it would have been too risky to have. You'd have had to have. I think we probably still did keep sentries out, but you had to clean up, because you just never knew until you'd. Really made a survey of the whole island, whether there were pockets of Japs that might have resisted. See, places like Moratai, they did get some who never, many years before they found out. So that was a pretty important part.
You mentioned that you met some of the Japanese soldiers.
Mm.
What was their feeling of honour or lack of having themselves lost the war?
I don't really know, because the ones I came in contact with, of course, didn't, except for the few in in Kuching who I really didn't speak to on anything like that. I was just giving instructions for what they had to do to hand over their arms and where they had to assemble and all that sort of stuff.
Well, what did that involve, and where were they then sent, having handed over their arms?
Well, they put into the, as I remember, they went into the camp where the where we took our people out of. Because a lot of the houses, see, the O'Connors, for instance, had a house in Kuching, and they went back to that, because I can remember getting food to them. A lot of the civilian who'd been there had somewhere to go back to, although, of course, they'd all been stripped. But the Japs were disassembled, and then we were taken out of that part of it. I went out of Kuching and back to Labuan after that had been, after things had been sorted out. The rest of the battalion came into Kuching, and we were there for a while doing, you know, sorting things out, and then I came home.
Tell us the process then of you coming home. Suddenly you're in war situation,
yeah,
now, okay,
yeah,
it's all over, you're off home.
Yeah, well, I just, they just asked you, they checked on your record as to how long you'd been in the services, and all those who'd done 5 years or more were on the top list to come home. So I came home with quite a few 2nd and 28th chaps, of course, too, came back. But
what was the atmosphere on board ship?
No, it was wonderful. Yes, it was great. It was a good trip home. Fantastic. Now, we landed in Brisbane, I think they dropped us off. Yes, Brisbane, came home and by train from Brisbane.
Welcoming parades?
No, not at that stage. I think I was out. No, there wasn't, because everybody was coming home dribbling back. And I sort of dribbled back. I didn't come back to the battalion at all, because the unit I'd been posted to was an Eastern States battalion anyhow. So I came back to West Australia, and the 28th fellows were coming back in dribs and drabs as they were eligible.
What was the situation then of being demobilised?
Well, we went to the army barracks at Karakata. And it all seemed so very simple after such a long time. You know, you just really were, you just out to be demobbed and you were free.
Mr. Civilian.
Yes, Mr. Civilian, yeah. Yes, it wasn't a very complicated process, because they had all your records. Yeah.
What was the release that you all felt on board ship coming home, realising it's all over, we're off home?
Oh, it was wonderful. No, it was a wonderful, wonderful experience to just be getting out of it all and knowing that there's no more to come.
What sort of celebrations did you undertake on board ship?
Oh, we had a few beers, as I remember. I think we had a few beers on board. But it was fairly subdued, really, because everybody really, then again, wondered what was ahead. You know, you knew you were going home, but you were going back to civilian life. What was it all going to hold after so many years?